It's a bird. It's a plane. It's a... Spoiler alert! Before listening, we will be spoiling parts of this film. If you wish to watch this film spoiler-free, turn back now before it's too late. Now, on with the show.
Warning. If you're adverse to having your opinions challenged, don't listen. Remember, it's just a movie.
Welcome to Postcut Feature Tableau. I am your actress of the stage and screen, Sarah Peterson. With me in this tableau today, I have VFX artist David Vierkamp.
Hey, what's up?
And I have writer and editor David M. Brown.
Hello.
And today we are going to talk about the much controversial film, The Joker. As you guys have accompanied us on our film journey, you have pretty much been the cornerstone of our podcast. And we thought, what better way to pay tribute to you guys than to bring a majority of your comments into our show. So on the controversy level, we just saw the Joker movie with Joaquin Phoenix, directed by Todd Phillips. First impressions of the film. David Brown, what did you think?
Right now, I've only seen it once, but this is a movie I could watch over and over again. Mm-hmm. This is a movie that, in terms of, you know, licensing for streaming and things like this, as soon as it comes out on a hard copy, buy it, because you want to own this. You don't want your streaming service to say, well, we're done. We don't have the contract for Joker anymore, so you don't have it. You will want this on hard copy for posterity. This movie will, in its present time, be completely underappreciated by critics, the media, and so on and so forth. But as it seeps into the collective unconscious of the audience, it will be a huge movie. People will talk about this, and it'll be one of those movies where people who dislike it at first will say in 10 years, oh yeah, I've always loved Joker with Joaquin Phoenix. I've always loved it.
Right.
That's the kind of movie this is.
Yeah. David Vierkamp, what is your first impression?
It's a poetic masterpiece. That's how I feel about it. It's amazingly written. It's beautifully done. I was in shock when I finished watching it. It just got my mind wired. I've never felt so related to a character ever. That's all I can say.
Yeah. My first impression, I was very impressed on the amount of emotion that they were able to draw from the Joker character himself. One of the things that I was really worried about was that they were going to go too much one way and not enough on another. And I really feel like as a independent character film, this one really was able to encompass everything. It was able to encompass the sympathy for the character. You were able to feel like he was the anti-hero that we've always looked for in the Joker. And I loved the fact it wasn't a Batman movie. I love Batman and I love everything to do with Batman. But the fact that we were able to focus solely on the descent into madness that the Joker was, I was completely blown away. I wasn't expecting it at all. It is 100% one of those films that I, as soon as Dave and I saw it the first time, I was like, we have to put this on our shelf. This has to be a movie that we own.
Oh, yeah.
And as a little treat to our viewers, because you guys are the cornerstone of everything that we are, we want to pay tribute to you guys. And so we posted on social media asking for reactions of the film.
And we got them.
Oh, did we get them?
Wow.
And the overwhelming majority of the responses that we received were very positive. There are going to be people everywhere that are going to dislike any film that is put out. It's going to happen. I was very surprised at the majority of the responses as being positive.
Well, I kind of attribute that to anybody who's going to dislike this movie is already going in with a preconceived notion of the character of the Joker.
Right.
Which is kind of expected.
That is what we talked about on our last Joker episode.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Don't go into this movie, and this is very serious. I don't usually kind of direct people to a certain way of watching a movie, but don't go in expecting Heath Ledger. Don't go in expecting Cesar Romero. Don't expect any version of the Joker that you have ever seen. Expect bits of all of them rolled up into one. But back to my point that I just made of the character being all of them rolled up into one, and it could be something as simple as his makeup. Like, yeah. I said to Dave when we got out of the theater, I said, his makeup around his mouth, the red part of his mouth, is Cesar Romero's Joker. It's just amped up in size.
Right.
You know, so even if it's that little tiny bit of an homage to a previous Joker, it adds to it. It doesn't take it away.
So this film pays tribute to the various areas in which all the Batman films were also filmed.
Mm-hmm.
You think New York, very gritty, very dark.
Chicago.
Chicago, like the alleyway kind of felt like it was a Chicago alleyway. Those different areas that these films were over the years created in, it definitely gave you that vibe that this was not a standalone Batman movie. This was a tribute movie to everything that has ever come out.
And speaking of years, the movie is done in a way to showcase that it's not done modern time.
Today, right.
Which is really subtle. You don't really notice it until you start realizing nobody's got cell phones out like day.
Right.
Nobody's got certain technologies aren't there. That all the cars are much more square and older and metallic. And you have like payphones and things like just things that you don't see today. It just grunges up that feeling.
Like I've said, I place this, if you're going to place it in a given year or right. span of years, I say late 70s, early 80s.
Right. What were you saying to me the other day about?
Batman the Animated Series is a mishmash of like modern stuff. Because if you look at like the Batmobile, it's a very modern, futuristic type of car. But like the mobsters are all dressed like 40s mobsters, overcoats and the hats and everything like that. So you're getting a mix.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is you can pick out certain eras, but it's not just in that one era.
Right.
It's a way of world building that can touch on anybody.
Right.
So like an older person could be sitting there watching the Batman animated series with a grandson. And
it blends timelines.
And that's exactly what Joker does here.
Yeah, it's a
modern day film. It has every sense of the word modern up until a given point. So it kind of takes place in the past, in a sense.
And you could argue as well that if you were watching this film in a modern perspective, with how poor they make the character out to be, because he's a performing clown.
Right.
He might not be able to afford a cell phone.
Correct.
Which, okay, that's fine. I mean, there are definite cues that are like, okay, this film is definitely not made for the modern time. And but you could argue that it could be in those senses.
That's a point I want to make. People are going to nitpick about stuff like that. Like, I've already seen nitpicking about, well, if Joaquin Phoenix Joker is about, say, 30 years old right now in this movie, and you see Bruce Wayne as a young boy, maybe, what, 10 years old?
I'd say he's like 10 or 12. Yeah, I wouldn't put somewhere. Him any higher
yeah.
than that.
He, max 12. Anywhere between 8 and 12. People are already saying, well, how could he be the Joker that Batman is dealing with when he's Batman? And you brought up that point. Well, yeah, he could be 60, but just about every iteration of the Joker has henchmen that do his bidding.
He doesn't go like toe-to-toe with Batman physically as
right.
much.
It's very rare that he does.
And when he is going toe-to-toe with Batman physically, you're looking at stuff like The Killing Joke. You watch him and he's being raised by Batman. The only physicality of it is that Batman is the first to strike.
Right.
So you never really see him box Batman or do anything of the physical sort with Batman. He always goes with a weapon or something of the like.
And not only that, I believe, I could be wrong on this because I'm not a comic reader anymore.
Right.
But I do believe this could be something that isn't necessarily canon in the comics. But I remember reading something about that there's a possibility or a theory that there are many Jokers. So you have a Joker.
Right.
Like Joaquin Phoenix when Bruce Wayne is a boy before his parents are killed. And then you have the Joker that takes on Batman in his 20s and then once in the 30s and then maybe retires and somebody else.
I've heard of that fan theory before. And I think a lot of it comes into play when you think about there are many different Batmans.
Mm.
There's always a Joker for a Batman. So I wonder if it's a play on words for that.
Mm, could be.
And if you want to say that this version of the Joker is the same Joker, well, he could probably not be that age as a character. He could be aging, like I think I mentioned this the other day, you know, he's smoking what, like 4 to 5
packs
a day, and he's on
and
medication.
I've also caught up on something because I saw the trailer again.
Uh-huh.
It's something that went past me. His physicality can indicate a hard drug addiction that he is coming off of, and that's probably why he needs certain medication, because it is mentioned that he's like on 8 medications or something like that.
Who knows what the side effects of that are,
right?
On
and
top
you,
of that.
Right, and you just look at his frame. He's bone thin. I mean, it's akin to Christian Bale in The Machinist. He's that kind of emaciated. That could be cocaine. That could be heroin. It could be a whole bunch of things. And now that I think about it, there is an insert shot of him like rubbing his arm, and he kind of always had long sleeves on.
Right.
When you see him out in the world, so that could be an indicator.
It could.
I'm not
be...
saying he is a heroin addict, but it's a possibility.
Right, and then we could also be reading too much into that.
Sure.
I mean,
there's a lot to read.
It's very easy to read into this film.
That's what's great about movies.
So going back to our viewer reviews from our social media, one of our reviewers was very adamant that Hollywood is just producing the same films, that they really have no original ideas. And if you listen to our podcast, you totally know that we are sick and tired of tropes.
Mm.
We're sick and tired of how Hollywood will always repeat a story over and over and over again.
How many Spider-Man movies have we remade? Oh.
Right. How many origin stories of Spider-Man do we have?
How many origin stories of Joker do we have?
Yeah. But the thing about the Joker, real quick, is that he technically has no official origin story.
Right.
So the next Joker film that comes out will be another origin story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
maybe
the thing.
And that's okay.
And we wanted to address that because we agree. Hollywood has been one of those big cash cows forever. And one of the opportunities that we kind of posed to this person was go out and make your own films. Become an independent film critic
or film
writer.
And if you can't do that, look up independent filmmakers and support them in their storytelling.
And we think it's great that he has this point of view, because if more people had the point of view, then maybe something would change in Hollywood. And we think that, honestly, and I can speak for all of us because I've sat in the room with how many times we've said this.
Oh my gosh, we're like a broken record.
It's like we're Hollywood. We just don't know how to get off
the
subject.
We keep repeating the same topic. Stop making the same stuff.
But it's people like us that make those changes in the world.
Sure.
And that was one of the things that I really appreciated that he brought to the discussion, because it is a broken record when it comes to origin stories. But we have to respect the fact that the Joker doesn't have an official origin story. So anybody can go and create whatever. I could create the origin story that he was a dancing fairy walking down the road and Batman just plucked him out of the air and he became the Joker.
Right.
Those are the origin stories that we can create from it. But what I think that this film does is it creates a commentary on society, and it uses the mask of the Joker to reach those that would never have seen that commentary before.
Yes, that is a very interesting way of putting it, because I guess I wouldn't say it's a counterpoint, but it's like a parallel point to this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that if this movie was not called The Joker and it had the same storylines,
right,
it'd be like this very intense thriller.
So if you look at one of our upcoming reviews is on a film that is very much a commentary on society. It wasn't posed in the same light. We're not going to reveal the title of the movie because you'll find out in our episode on Next Gen.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that's really great about this upcoming episode is that it's a commentary on society. It's a commentary on how we don't listen as a society.
Mm.
And it did not reach the accolades that I think this film will reach because it wasn't masked in any way. It was completely what an independent film would be.
And to say to the Facebook commenter that you mentioned had a dislike for Joker and that Hollywood movies are all the same.
We had more than one.
Yeah, we have more than one dissent, and that's good. But to my point, it's a movie that won a lot of awards that are independent awards.
Mm-hmm.
It was not brought up for Best Picture or Best Screenplay
for
Hollywood.
No, not at all.
But the independent film community knows a really good film generally when they see one.
Right.
And they will promote it and they will give it awards that it does
right.
deserve.
I think it's very interesting the way that they executed this film. Todd Phillips most likely wrote this original story. And, you know, what's the best way to get someone to see your story? By masking it as another type of movie.
Right. And you're getting all sorts of people walking in expecting a Joker Batman fight movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I heard it announced, that's exactly what I thought it was. And I said, oh my gosh.
Especially with the way the trailer
acted. And really quickly, it was written by Todd Phillips and Scott Silver.
That's true. Yes.
Oh, well, nice.
Mm-hmm.
So honestly, I think that they had a wonderful marketing direction on it. Because like I said, I was expecting a Batman Joker brawl. Because based off of what I saw on Suicide Squad, I didn't realize that it was going to be an independent film. because they never really marketed it that way. Mm. I was like, I don't know how I feel about this, but I think I have to go see it to make my opinion.
They were trying to get butts in theater. That's all the marketing does.
I think the marketing, it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't marketed as the shoot 'em up, fight 'em up, Batman right. kind of thing. It was marketed as an origin story for Joker. And we will be bringing this up in another tableau about the problems with trailers. These trailers that I've seen for Joker gave nothing away about this movie. Other than it's an origin story right. for this character.
So, and I would disagree with that after the fact. Leading up to the film, it didn't have anything to do with what the movie was about. Now that the film's out in theaters, I was just watching on my friend's Facebook page today. You know how when you put in Facebook that you're watching a particular film, it'll pull up the trailer for that film? Well, the trailer's much more in-depth now.
Right, it's one of the final trailers.
Right. So, I mean, leading up to the film, I agree. It did a wonderful job of keeping the story under wraps. Mm. Now that the film is out and it's being consumed by the public, I would say that it's a little bit more direct in the idea that, yes, it's an origin story. No, it's not the Batman origin story that you expect, but it is a descent into madness, which is a great social commentary on our media, which is one of our other wonderful reviewers mentioned in their commentary. And if you look at our media today, it is a circus. No matter where you go.
No matter which side you're on.
No matter which side you're on, someone is creating some form of spectacle.
And you're going to get responses of this movie from both sides.
Right.
You're going to get the conservative side. You're going to get the liberal and the progressive side. You're going to get all of those. And everyone's going to read the movie to be their movie.
Their anti-movie.
Right. Or their anti-movie. Exactly. If they can't kind of figure out what would be for them in the movie, they're going to just rail against it.
And you know what's funny about that is because of the targeted ads on Facebook, I'm getting more positive responses to the movie on my Facebook page than I was getting on my work computer. When I would open up my email at work, it would give me, you know, those weird ads that come up, whatever. And I noticed that after I started talking about the movie at work, and this is where, you know, our big brother likes to pay attention to us when it comes to social media. At work, I would start getting positive reviews. I'm not able to find the negative responses to the movie anymore. Not to say that there isn't any, because clearly, as our Facebook responses have shown, there is negative feedback.
Which we thank everyone for being honest about their opinion, too, because I would prefer to get a very unbiased grouping of opinions than trying to get something that's one-sided.
Right. I really love what we do here because we are about constructive criticism. We are about having those different viewpoints. And I think it's great that even our listeners or our viewers on our social media are expressing those viewpoints. And we're never going to belittle you on social media. So if you're just going onto our page to just get your opinion out, that's great. But we're never gonna belittle your opinion. We always want to hear, honestly, not just trying to be negative for negative sake or anything like that.
And like you said, we're getting a lot of positive reviews.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting more positive reviews than negative ones on the Facebook page. I think that goes to people are starting to open up to what's happening,
right?
To a certain extent, and whether they like it or dislike it, they're talking about it.
And I think that was the whole point of the marketing of the film, is to get people
to
talking
start the
about
conversation.
It.
Yeah.
One of the commentators that we were just currently viewing on YouTube,
Upper Echelon Gamers, is his channel.
He has a very similar viewpoint that the media is the basically big bad of this film, and that media wants this film to fail.
The title of the piece is Why the Media Needs the Joker to Fail.
No, it's very insightful and a very analytical breakdown of why.
I found it after the night we watched the movie.
Yeah.
I got home, and because of my drive, I'm wired after the drive. I can't fall asleep right away.
Well, I mean, you were wired right after that movie, especially.
Sure.
That one.
And I found this, and I'm like, oh, that looks really interesting. And it's, what, a 15-minute piece thesis about putting a mirror up to society and media in general, and how either they're not seeing it or they do see it and they don't want people to see it. So they fight it in a sense. Go watch it. It's really good.
It is. What I loved about looking that particular person up on YouTube was one of the recommended videos was there have been no shootings. So the incels haven't done their job when it comes to this film. insinuating that there was a potential that the media was trying to incite this.
And he brings that
violent,
up.
Violent. Yeah, he brings it up. And
he brings up the idea that this movie is an instruction manual for incels and things like that, which I know what an incel is, and I don't see that anywhere in this movie.
I don't either. And to be completely honest with you, not going into any details on what happened with the Dark Knight tragedy, but if people were actually hoping that something like that would happen again with this film, it's kind of sad to show the commentary on our society in that sense, because look at what the media was in his thesis. He brings up that the media was trying to insinuate some form of violence during this movie.
Right.
One of the things that kind of upsets me a little bit is how the media can manipulate people in that way. And I like the fact that the film definitely covers that.
Sure.
Watch any part of the film. When he's going on the Murray show. I love how he says it that way. It's amazing.
Dude, he's just so...
He's insinuating the violence against Joker in the sense that he puts on his comedy act without any form of...
Consent.
Consent or release.
Right.
To make fun of him.
To make fun of him. So he's bullying this guy.
And Joker gets back at him when Murray comes in to talk to him before going on the show. He's like, oh, you know, the one guy is played by Marc Maron. He's the PA. He's like, I told you, we shouldn't bring this guy. He's weird. It's like, no, that's okay. But the Joker starts to make, and they're very little kind of demands on Murray.
Yeah, they're so subtle.
So subtle. Like he says, oh, and one more thing. When you introduce me, can you introduce me as Joker? And he says, yeah, sure. Why do you want to change your name? Well, that's what you called me when you showed my comedy routine.
And he said it as an insult.
Yes. He was what I learned how to do in retail, is to insult someone without them knowing they've just been insulted.
Oh, I love
that. In such a nice way. But when you know how it's done, you see it immediately.
And that part right there really pulls at your heartstrings. Mm-hmm. If you've been bullied, as a person who's been bullied, or anybody who has been bullied in our audience, you understand how he feels in that sense.
Yeah. Oh my God, you do. Because he's being bullied because of his mental disability. And he's constantly being bullied for that. He is stuck with this his entire life, and everyone is just beating him into the ground. How would anyone feel?
And think about that. They're beating him into the ground. Think just
right
literally
from the beginning of the movie.
Right from the very beginning of the movie.
The title sequence.
He
is
being beaten
into the ground.
Into the ground.
And it's a beautiful reversal of Blake Snyder's form of writing when he writes a script. You have to have the Save the Cat moment. He has a book called Save the Cat. And basically the Save the Cat moment is when you make the audience like or dislike a character. So the example in the book is Al Pacino's it's a cop movie. And it opens with him at one of those police things where they bring people in to arrest them. And so Al Pacino is at this police thing where they bring people in to arrest them without their knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of walks out for a cigarette, and he sees one of the criminals he's looking for, but the criminal has his child with him. And it's something like get tickets for like a monster truck or something like that. I don't know. But he sees the criminal sees him, and they lock eyes. And Al Pacino looks at him and says, oh, I'm sorry, but all the tickets are gone. So you kind of missed it. You're a little late. I'm sorry, but, you know, we don't have any more. And the criminal looks at his son and says, well, son, you know, sometimes we're late. You know, sorry, we can't do it. And the criminal, as he's leaving, looks back at Pacino, and Pacino looks at him and says, catch you later. And they bring that full circle at the end. He finally catches him. But what does that do? It makes Al Pacino's character kind of a nice guy.
Yeah.
He didn't want to arrest the guy in front of his son. So you kind of like Al Pacino. In the opening of The Joker, here's this guy dressed as a clown, doing his job, promoting like a sale or something at somebody's store, and a bunch of teenagers, young men, come up, and they steal his sign. He chases them through the city, and then they hit him with the sign, and then they just beat him for no reason.
No reason at all.
This tells you society is the antagonist and the bad guy, and look at our poor character here laying in the dirt. All he was doing, and this goes back to the political side of the movie, he's just a worker. He's just trying to do his job and make a living. And look what happens to him.
And the only negative connotation that you have for this character at all is that you know he's the Joker. That's the only negative connotation you have. So you go in with this preconceived notion that he's the bad guy. And everything.
He's the protagonist.
Like, and he's in this film, he's the protagonist.
Everyone's expecting like a Deadpool or something like that.
Right.
Right. And it's kind of interesting to me. I really liked the scenes where they're flipping through his book.
Mm.
And you get those little glimpses into his psyche. I hope my death makes more sense than my life. Sense spelled C-E-N-T-S.
Mm.
It's like one of those things where if you're a suicidal person, you have those kind of thoughts.
Sure.
If you're a depressed person, you for sure have those thoughts. But think about, why did he spell it sense, C-E-N-T-S, and every other word was spelled correctly?
It's a money issue.
It's a money issue.
It's also foreshadowing.
Because the first time you see that, he's still taking care of his mother,
mm-hmm.
who, in almost a strange way, he's kind of planning. You get the sense that he's planning on killing himself, and he hopes at some point maybe that will help take care of his mother. Maybe they'll give her some kind of
right.
bereavement payment or something. I don't know.
So, I mean, I think that's interesting. The other part that I think is really interesting, he switches his handwriting throughout the film.
Mm.
So I have a theory that he's switching hands that he's writing with.
Could be.
In which case, I think he has multiple personality disorder.
It could be.
It could be.
But there's also the fact that people are ambidextrous and they can write with both hands.
So if you look at the Joker in general, he's like Two-Face in the sense that he has a multiple personality. Original personality is going to be the man that the Joker was.
Right.
The flip side of that is the Joker side of the man. So I think in his insane, sane version, it's paying homage to that in the sense that he does not become the Joker until he falls into the vat of chemical, right? That's all the origin stories that we've ever seen with Joker. It's not existent. If you think about it, him switching his hands is him going from Arthur to Joker. It's a switch on him. And the line that he writes in that moment is, the worst part about having a mental illness is that people expect you to behave as if you don't.
Yeah, and you know what? Now that you've kind of explained that to me, you're right. I think part of his mental illness is multiple personality.
And I wouldn't say because they wouldn't know. You never know in the instance of multiple personality.
Which then goes back to, I can hearken this back to the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock, with Psycho, at the end of Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
The psychiatrist says, when the mind houses two personalities, there's always a conflict, a battle, and the dominant personality always wins.
Right.
So at the end, the dominant personality is Joker, and it wins out.
Right.
Arthur is gone.
Arthur,
and
yeah.
That brings me to one of my favorite scenes in the movie, and that is when Arthur is told that he is losing his job, that he has been fired. He is in his clown costume that he works in, and he's at a payphone. He's in a payphone booth like you would see Superman change into. It's an old glass payphone booth. Arthur takes his head, and he hits the glass of the payphone booth twice, and on the second hit, he spider webs the glass, a visual indication of Arthur has just broken.
Especially after you've gotten the shot just previously when they're talking about him being in a mental institution
and
he's hitting his head on the glass of the door.
Exactly.
And nothing happens.
Right. He's not broken at that point. And you just get this beautiful shot of the glass breaking, and that's what it is. And from that moment on, that's when he stops taking his medication.
Right.
They show him take like one last dose, and that's over. And that's when his final descent starts to take place.
Because after the smash with his head, the scene right after that is the scene on the train.
Where he kills the
Right, where he interrupts
the Wall Street guys.
Right, where he interrupts the three, as Thomas Wayne put it, the three upstanding citizens
who were about to rape that woman. Yeah.
I don't care what anybody says, they were going to rape that woman.
Oh, they totally were.
And just by his condition that he laughs at inappropriate times kind of saved her, it gave her the opportunity to get up. Because now he's distracted
right.
the three from the woman, so she takes her opportunity, gets up, and walks out.
He distracts the woman, and then obviously brings attention of three guys who are drunk as who knows what.
Yeah,
Or they're on whatever substances.
Yeah, they're on enough stuff, and they start mocking him. They
the
take
one
his
guy
hat.
Had the munchies because he was talking
and
about
And what
the
do they do? They beat him into the ground.
Yeah.
Again. And this time, what does he do?
He gets up.
He has a gun and he defends himself.
And that's the one thing.
They say this movie is violent in the media. Yet, there's only maybe about 5 people who die. And the only reason they say it's violent. I mean, look at Avengers. Thousands of people die.
Right. They destroyed New York in Avengers.
Yeah. You drop a continent on a country and thousands of people die. But you see 5 people die in this movie and that's too violent?
And you see all those buildings in the Avengers topple down. And nobody thinks, while there are actual people in those buildings, but because I think what they did was with the violence in this, you said it, it's so visceral.
Right.
And
personal.
The other thing about the media manipulation is no one from the media was there to see the event happen, but you were there as an audience member, and you know that those three deaths are self-defense. And I don't care if you chase the last guy down into the station like the Joker does and shoots him in the back. It's still self-defense.
It is, because had he not shot him in the leg,
right,
he probably would have kept beating him. And this brings me to a point that I just came up with in this discussion. Them beating him into the ground, if you watch the first scene, he just stays curled there, which means that he does want to die. He doesn't want to get up. He's tired of being beaten down.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment that he defends himself against the Wall Street guys, it's like he has this renewed passion for life, in a sense.
That's because Arthur Fleck isn't defending him. Joker, the other personality,
well,
is defending.
Well, I was going to say, because in the loss of the job, that was the only spark of life that Arthur had was the job. And he says it. He's like, I love this job. I love it. You can't take that away from me. And the moment that that is taken from him, that is Arthur's death.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where Joker stays.
Yeah.
And that's when you get into this descent into madness, that the world could be considered the metaphor for the vat of acid that most origin stories have. Because as he's being thrust into this world, he's being forced further and further down into this deep rabbit hole of madness, that finally, when he has this moment to emerge, he emerges as a new person. He's basically the phoenix of the story.
Right, and he's totally accepting of that new personality, of that new way of thought.
In such a dynamic way, because immediately after he kills the guys, he goes and, in his mind, has sex with this woman.
Which, by the way, that was a great switch.
And I just thought of it now. The scene where he's coming down the stairs, going to the Murray show. Yeah.
The Murray.
And he's dancing. He's enjoying his descent.
Yeah.
Because those contrasting scenes of him coming home as Arthur.
Oh, it really is a descent. Descent down the stairs, but it's a descent of his character.
He's walking up the stairs, and he's just, like you say, he's beaten down. It's a mountain to climb just to get to his home.
Well, and that's the thing is, when you see him as Arthur, he's always climbing up the stairs.
Right.
He's trying to claw his way
back up to almost normalcy. And then as the Joker, he is descending and he is enjoying his descent. He is reveling in his descent. And when someone sees him, the two cops see him, he runs. And that brings me to Dave's point, and Dave can iterate it better, but the chase on the train.
Oh, gosh.
You were talking about how organic that scene was.
So if you, we were just stating, the movie is visual poetry, but if you know the character of the Joker, the moment that you really feel like he is like that iconic character is the chase on the train. It's right after his descent on the stairs. The two detectives catch him. He's running across the street. He gets hit by a car and gets back up and keeps going. Like,
right.
And he's like bony as heck. You know?
Yeah, so,
he would never have survived that if he was really, honestly.
Crazy adrenaline.
Yeah, he would have been, he would have been almost crushed to dust in a sense. And kudos to the Facebook person who said that they liked his run. They really thought his run was
funny. Yeah, he runs lanky and,
He runs like a kid.
Yeah.
And not only that, but he runs as if he's got nothing to lose.
That's what is true. He gets to the train, he slips onto the train, barely in enough time, the cops get on the train too. These are the two detectives who have been tailing him,
yeah.
So they're familiar-ish. But the train's full of people with clowns because he's inadvertently started a movement with those the self-defense murders.
Correct.
But they pinned it on a clown.
Right, they pinned it on somebody else. They didn't know who did it.
And so they're chasing him through, and he's trying to slip by, and it's hard for him to be seen, but he's still clearly distinct enough. He grabs some random mask off some guy and starts a brawl.
Right.
And just keeps going. And these two other guys, now
which
there's this
would be a very Joker thing to do.
Right.
Now he's caused a little chaos.
Take your mask, that guy did.
Right. And he does it so quickly that people don't even notice him. He's so elusive. But
because he's blending in because he's in the clown makeup and so forth.
So he keeps going. And what happens next is the cops get to the point where the brawl's happening. Some guy grabs the cop's gun. There's a struggle. Mm-hmm. And the cop kills the protester.
Right.
An innocent protester. And Joker's kind of in the back watching. And all of a sudden, all these clowned protesters attack and beat the cops into the ground.
Which?
And they bring him out of the train. And that's where Joker kind of wins, because the cop is looking at him, or he's looking at the cop, and he lifts the mask up to show him that, I'm the one you're chasing, but you're not going to get me. And he dances like this little jig, like, ha ha. And then he turns around and puts the mask in the garbage and goes on his way.
And it's beautiful.
And he's not even.
It is this descent, the completion of the descent right at the end of the stairs.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's the completion of the descent.
Because you have to go further down into the subway.
Right. Because you have to think about this, too. He's not going to be noticed.
Right.
And that makes it beautiful. Because in The Dark Knight, he mentions how he's the man without a plan.
Right.
And how he always seems to be able to pull these things off without this quote-unquote plan.
But he is the man with the plan in The Dark Knight. And in this one, he's not.
It's beautiful, beautiful tribute to that line.
And you also say that in that moment, he's not noticed. But what happens is at the end, once he kills Murray and some of the other people in the studio, and he's captured by the police, an ambulance hits the cop cars. They're taking him to the hospital or to the police precinct. And out of the ambulance comes two of the protesters with the clown masks on.
Yeah.
And they look in the back seat and they see him. Now, it's at first you're thinking, do they know he's the guy from television? Do they know he's the Joker? And they take him out of the car. And it's a reverent moment. They carry him and they gently put him on the hood of the police car.
It's contrast to the beginning.
And they're like trying to take care of him. They're like, back up. You know, they're trying to wake him up. Hey, wake up. Are you okay? Are you okay? And he eventually wakes up and he looks and he stands up on the cop car and they all start cheering him. And he revels in that. He revels in the fact that they like him. And this is the rebellious part of society that actually says to certain groups, hey, wait a second, aren't we supposed to help one another when we're down? And look what can happen when we do help. And they take this man and they literally put him, in a sense, where he should be, back in the hospital, in the psychiatric ward. But at least there, he's getting some form of help, which I don't think will ever help him anymore.
Right. Well, and if you look at it in terms of, this film is definitely political in nature.
Mm.
Definitely. So you look at the instances of cops killing anybody.
Anybody, right.
Anybody. And I'm not even talking about when you look at the response of cops killing any unarmed person,
mm-hmm.
which is basically what the cop did on the train for this movie. You're looking for that savior. You're looking for that person to stand up and say, this is not right.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, they're looking at the Joker in that same concept.
Right.
Because he is the one who has come out on television and said, I was the one who killed those Wall Street guys.
Right.
He is the one who is expected to be on that pedestal, and he accepts it with a gracious, bloody smile.
Right. A quick side note, when he kills the three Wall Street guys on the train, I believe that is taken from a 1980s case, the Bernie Goetz case.
Oh, yeah.
But he was on a train, and he had a gun with him, and three people came up to him, and he said he felt threatened and that he had been mugged before, so he shot him. But he was put away they said it wasn't self-defense, so on and so forth, and he was still put away. And that goes back to the media of the idea of, you know what the Joker did in this movie was self-defense, but the media immediately paints him as a killer.
Killer clown.
Right.
This callous,
psycho killer clown.
And in that point, Thomas Wayne comes out and they ask him about it. And he says something along the lines of, this person, he kills these three upstanding young men who've been going to college and making money and all this other stuff. And he wears a mask. Only cowards wear masks. Well, I hate to tell you something, Thomas Wayne. One day your son will wear a mask and be a vigilante. So is your son a coward?
Well, I mean, technically you could look at it as Batman's a coward. He wants to hide his real identity.
Right. And then you go back to The Dark Knight, and I know I'm getting totally down the rabbit hole here, but during the one we covered of the interrogation scene, after Batman beats him, he's sitting on the floor, and he tells the guard, when he says, how many of your friends have I killed? And he says, six. And the Joker mouths that, six. He says, would you like to know how many of them were cowards? And it's because he says, when you do that, people show you who you are at their death.
Right.
So, but that goes to that point. I caught on that right away, that Thomas Wayne dies and doesn't know what his son becomes because of that. But it's just a great shot at Batman, really.
Right.
And I enjoyed that.
And
I like Batman. So
that brings us and a great point. One of the commenters on the Facebook page mentioned how they disliked how Thomas Wayne was portrayed. And they mentioned that he was potentially, that he was portrayed as a callous person.
The person basically says he's a bad guy. if you look at our Facebook page, you'll see the comment.
That lends us to a really good character analysis of Thomas Wayne,
mm-hmm.
which I think that you definitely mentioned a lot more eloquently than I will. So if you could take that away, David Brown.
Okay. Basically, the movie paints Thomas Wayne. He's painted with a broad brush. I will say that right away to cover the, I would imagine, the super rich in our society, in that they come out and they talk a good rhetoric of, and Thomas Wayne says it, we're going to be here to, you know, bring these poor people out of poverty and to help them and get them on the road to like success or something like that.
Whatever his PR agent told
exactly.
him.
Exactly.
Right.
That's not true. It's just not true. There are some people who are rich and have just gobs of money that do give to charity and things like that. And a lot of times you don't hear about them because they don't necessarily need the accolades of,
right.
hey, I've made $3 billion in my life. I'm giving back a little bit. We do it with athletes a lot because we like to put athletes up on a pedestal. So when the big...
Which is funny because they actually go on pedestals when they win things.
Right, true. We do that a lot with athletes because they're in the spotlight and we like, you know, the society, we're a sports society and there's nothing wrong with that. You like sports and I'm not saying you shouldn't do that.
Sports or the gladiators.
Right,
again,
and I'm
right?
not saying you shouldn't be agreeable and say, hey man, when you get a famous NBA player or football player or something like that and they say, you know, hey, he's giving back to his community because he can. It's a good thing, and I don't care about I like that kind of press for somebody. I really do. It shows that they do care about their community. Even like the simplest things, when you see an athlete just talk to a little kid fan for 5 minutes and sign his autograph, you've made that kid's day. That's a good thing. Thomas Wayne is painted with a broad brush as all of the super rich or most of the super rich who look down upon working people and people who, for some reason or another, can't find a good job, maybe because they had to quit their education to take care of an ailing parent or a younger sibling or something like that. And they'll tell them that it's their fault that they're not rich because they don't work hard enough or you didn't educate yourself or something like that. Well, they couldn't because they had to stop their education in order to take care of their family.
Or they have a brain condition, then they
right.
can't. That's just
or mental illness. I'm sorry, but people with mental illness, at least some, are not capable of working because they can't.
Well,
they can't
and,
deal
and
with
that.
And that
lends to the job that Joker has. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to call him Joker from now on because
yeah, he's Joker.
He's totally Joker.
The movie's called Joker. He's called Joker. Just, I mean, Robert De Niro calls him Joker.
he's a performing clown whose name is Carnival.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anybody caught that.
I did.
I think that was probably the best session of therapy that they could have put in there. Well, I was listening to this guy and he said that life's a carnival and I had to laugh because, you know, that's my clown name. Like, I think that's beautiful because it just shows his string of consciousness. Because at this point, he's already lost his job. So we know that he's descending into that form of madness. But he's still talking about the job as if he currently owns it.
And he says something along the lines of, for all my life, I've questioned my existence.
Right.
And he says, but now I know I exist. And it's almost like confirmation because the guy uses the name Carnival.
It's crazy. Mm-hmm. It's one of those moments that if you watch once, you're like, huh. But Dave Vierkamp and I saw it twice. And it really adds to the heartbreak. Because this whole entire time, you know, from the moment that he starts to the moment that he gets fired, you know that he's just trying to pave his way in the world. Like every single one of us. We are the Joker. We're trying to claw our way up the poverty line. Or we're trying to claw our way up from student loan debt. From
anything.
Anything. Medical debt. Anything at all. You think about what we have to face as a society. And we ourselves are Arthur in the sense that we're trudging through our lives trying to get ahead in the world. And that's what he was trying to do.
Yeah. And I think the analogy, I mean, one of the analogies, because there's so many from this movie you can take away, is that, look, this guy tried to do everything right along the lines of right.
Mm-hmm.
And the society made it that much harder for him. So he ended up losing his mind and throwing that rule book away and descending into a crazy man.
Where everything made sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like you think about it, everything he did in that scene with Murray made sense.
And why do we put people like that? Why do we let this happen?
Mm.
And the funny
It's entertainment when you think about it.
It is.
I want to say something, and it goes to a future episode of Post Cut Film Podcast. We our lives have become our own entertainment. And you made a comment about we are the Joker in the movie.
Yes.
And I think that is what is the base for the negative comment, because people see that, and maybe, just maybe, this piece of art, and I don't say that about a lot of movies, but this is a piece of art, and it is really good, and maybe it's done its job with a few people, and they've opened their eyes, and they've said, why does this movie disturb me? And maybe on some subconscious level, they know they're the Joker. They're that little guy that the rich laugh at, and that you're robbed trying to do your own job, just trying to make it in the world and be a decent human being.
Do you know what I think is interesting is that the majority of the comments that have been negative on this film have been from older generations? I don't think that it is far-fetched enough for me to say this, but this film resonates with millennials way more than it would ever resonate with someone of the older generation.
Of the boomer generation?
Of the boomer generation, because...
Well, and I'll tell you, and let me say this, and this is not to disparage the boomer generation, but the boomer generation came after World War II, and one of the reasons that the United States became what it is in terms of its power and its wealth is because the rest of the world was in total chaos and destruction. England had no manufacturing. Japan had no manufacturing anymore. My God, Germany was completely obliterated. The only place that really could pick up and start to manufacture was the U.S.
Because we weren't touched by the... We weren't technically touched.
We weren't as touched as much as they were. And not only that, that's one of the reasons why we were part of the winning side of that war, because we were an industrial power. And there's that change over in society. We are no longer an industrial society. We are a technological society now. And older generations don't understand technology, and it scares them.
I was going to bring up the fact that after World War II, there had to be an influx of the manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
So that is why the boomer generation has much more wealth than what we have as millennials. Because if you look at it, we've been saddled with student loan debt because we've been told our entire lives that you have to get a higher education. You have to get a higher education. You can't go into the trades because it's not worth it. You have to get a bachelor's degree. You have to get your master's.
Completely wrong.
Right.
Because not everybody can be the CEO of a company. Not everybody wants to be the CEO of a company. Some people want to be a mechanic. And I say to that person who wants to be a mechanic or a truck driver or any kind of like tradesman, go do it, because that's what you want to do. It's called achieving your dream. And if your dream is that, if your dream is as simple as having a good job
and being a clown
and being a clown, go do it, because that's the whole point of it.
And that I think is the whole point of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because he probably could have found a better job.
Sure.
But he enjoyed being the clown.
Mm-hmm.
He enjoyed being able to go out there and put a smile on a child's face at the children's hospital
and
or
I say,
like that.
And I say this now as you brought it up. He could have possibly, with certain different societal or environmental conditions mm-hmm. taken away from him in terms of like a mental illness.
Right.
And people just beating him for no reason. He very well could have opened his own clown business like he was working for.
Right.
And could have been the main clown. And, you know, he could have done that.
Right.
And competed with the other guy and maybe even put him out of business or something
right.
like that.
And it just goes to show that we look down on these people who have mental illnesses, invisible illnesses. We look down on people who are different than us as a society. And I think it was a commentary on that. I definitely mm-hmm. think it was a commentary on the generational gap. Because if you look at him versus his mother, I mean, there's very much a different generational feel, because his mother's all like, oh, Thomas Wayne will help us. You know, we're family for him, you know, trying to rely on the wealth of another. Whereas he was like out there in the trenches trying to pave his own way.
And this goes to when he meets Thomas Wayne in the bathroom of the theater. Thomas Wayne says, oh, what do you want, money? He's like, no, I don't want anything from you other than maybe the acknowledgement that possibly you are my father.
Right.
Which is proven
some
in the end that it's not.
That's all he wanted was
right.
Some decency.
He says that. I just want some basic human decency.
And that is sad, because you think about that, all he's looking for is a hug. He says that too.
Right.
Maybe I just want a hug, Dad.
Right.
Maybe some human decency.
And what does he do? He punches him.
Right.
Thomas Wayne punches the Arthur.
And it's one of those things, I joke around with my coworkers that they're my captive audience and that I'm lonely because I have basically one person in the world to talk to. But it's true. You think about it, when you are living with someone and you're that person for that for someone, you become lonely. Mm. You become that person that just all they want is a hug from someone else. And it's a sad commentary to say it that way, but it's exactly how Arthur felt in that moment.
Because he has the fantasy of Murray hugging him.
Right.
Bringing him out of the audience and hugging him while he's watching the show.
And it's so sad. On the majority of the positive comments, a lot of the people really enjoyed...
They enjoyed Joaquin Phoenix's performance.
Oh, yeah. One of the commenters also said that he deserved an Academy Award for his performance, which...
And I wholeheartedly agree with that comment.
I agree.
Same.
That is such a hard role to jump into in general. I mean, look at what it did to Heath Ledger.
Sure.
Look at what it did to Jared Leto. No matter how much of that was publicity, you know that it did something.
Oh, and look at how much he starved himself. Look at The Machinist. How did he eat?
I know.
Right. It's, yeah.
And I've read that he said that it's basically like an eating disorder because you're like, oh, I got to get down that 0.25 kilograms. Like, I understand that.
And he gained all the way back for like two interviews that I saw recently.
Oh, good.
I'm like, what? I'm like, what?
Well, once you've starved yourself for that long, your body's going to take
anything back. I bet he ate so many french fries.
He definitely deserves something for that. I don't think that, I hope he got help during the time of him filming, because that had to have been a very hard headspace to be in.
Oh, I can imagine. But
and
yeah.
His laugh, can we comment on the laugh right now? Oh,
oh
my God.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
It's no Mark Hamill, but holy, holy cow.
And it's no Heath Ledger or Cesar Romero or Jack Nicholson.
But I mean... That laugh.
It's solely Joaquin Phoenix.
And it's painful. You see the pain on his face when he's laughing.
That shot when he's walking out of the clown shop where he works.
Putting his shirt on.
He's putting his shirt on. That is one of the most disturbing parts of his laughter is that he's walking away from those people. And he gets to that really high pitch for the first time.
And you know what's even the creepiest part about that laugh too? Is as soon as it stops, he's frowning. He's like, he had no emotion when he was laughing.
Right, when he's done, yeah.
Like, and the only time that he's really smiling is when he has blood on his face.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great little attention.
Especially at the end when he like you say, he brings the blood up for his smile is the paint.
And yeah. That was one of the things that even when he killed his fellow clown in the apartment,
yeah.
You saw him kind of smirk a little bit. And I was like, ah, that's such a relief because I really hated that guy.
Dude, he was a jerk. He caused
the gun problem.
He caused a domino effect of certain problems in the movie. Not all of them, but because he had the gun, it led to the firing, which led to a big, big pivotal point.
Right, and that was...
And then how he treats the little person.
Yeah.
Because the little person is just scared to death. And what does the Joker do? He looks at him and he says, "You've always been nice to me. You can go."
And
now then he
the
scares
decency.
Him later. He kind of... Because he doesn't want to walk past the body. And I think that scare where he jumps at him is just to push him past the dead body to get out of the door.
Right. It's his shred of human decency.
Right. It's kind of that last shred of, but it's Joker being Joker. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You don't know what he's going to do. You know, you don't know if he's going to shoot you or if he's going to let you go.
Right. And one of our commenters also said this was an epic satire, which I thought was a very apt comment to have about it, because it was definitely a satire on everything.
Yes, it was.
Which one thing I do need to say. So Todd Phillips, does everyone know what he's famous for directing?
Mm.
Borat, The Hangover Part 2, and The Hangover Part 3. This is a guy who's only done like ridiculous
epic satires.
Well, epic comedies.
And satires.
And satires, but mostly in a comedic format. And then you got this really distinct contrast to that. I think it's interesting when we see directors break free of what they're notorious for doing and they try something new. I always like it when people do that because you always get something different and interesting, no matter what. Say try something.
Well, I think I said this to you on the way home from the movie. You can look at this movie and somewhat categorize it as a dark comedy.
Yeah.
Well, and he says it himself. He's like, I once thought my life was a tragedy, And then as he's killing his mom and he's like, but I've realized that it's a comedy.
It's a comedy.
So, I mean, this film has a lot to take away from it. If you don't like the film, we can understand why.
Yeah,
it's one of those films that definitely has to be taken as a with a grain of salt. It's not something that can 100%, it cannot be called a superhero movie.
No.
Or a supervillain movie. Mm. It definitely thrusts you into the arms or world of the Joker.
Sure.
And if you have like mental illness or thoughts of just dark thoughts in general, this might not be the movie for you.
Do not see this film. If you have any form of mental illness that is on the extreme nature.
Right. Try and get some help.
Yeah.
Please reach out for help. Do not go see this film. Do not attempt to do anything of the nature of the Joker because it will not work out for you.
No.
We strongly advise that anybody who needs help should seek for help because no matter what, there is someone out there. Sure. There will always be someone out there. Even if it's your next door neighbor and all you want is a hug, and most consenting people will give you a hug.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of those things. Moving forward, we want to thank everyone who interacted with us on our social media page.
Yes, thank you all.
You guys are the cornerstone, like I said before, of everything that we do. We bring this podcast to you because we love films, but we love having those dissenting opinions to offset the love of any film.
It's always good to have a devil's advocate.
That's right.
And so we encourage you, please, if you're listening to our show, follow us on our social media pages. We have an Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. We are Post Cut Podcast. And guess what? We have a website, people.
Published today.
We just published our website. It is live and running. If you want to send us some listener mail that we can read on the show, we won't say your full name, but if you're okay with it, we'll say your first name. Go ahead and send it in. We are listenermail@postcutpodcast.com.
You can also reach us on the contact page on our website.
Overall, I think I can speak for the group when I say that we loved this film.
Mm-hmm.
This is a film that we think will go down in history as one of the top 100s that you should see before you die.
Definitely pick up a copy when it comes out on Blu-ray or DVD.
I'm sure definitely. That there's going to be extras that are going to be fantastic.
Oh, the pre-order for this DVD and Blu-ray is going to be insane. Bad pun, because it's the Joker, insane. Sorry, I didn't intend for that to be a pun, but there you go.
One thing to mention, also for some podcast info. If you like our show and have been listening for a while now, there's actually a way you can support us, and that's through our Ko-fi account. So you can go to ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com/postcutpodcast, and you could donate
whatever you want.
Whatever you want, yeah. Because
any contribution is appreciated.
Yes.
And just so you guys are aware, we will be hopefully releasing in the interim more of these feature tableaus. So if you want to hear anything in terms of discussion on tropes in Hollywood or discussion of what's wrong with film trailers today, please check out our social media and leave us a comment because we always want to hear from you.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have specific topics about film that you want us to engage in, just tell us what you want to talk about.
If you have questions about how movies are made or VFX or editing or directing or anything like that, we will do our best to answer those questions. And if we can't answer them ourselves, we'll point you in the right direction.
And one other thing is we really, solely from the bottom of our hearts, really appreciate you guys. And just keep being awesome. We're almost at 200 plays as of today for our podcast, which for us, we never would have dreamed would have been possible for us. So thank you.
And also been an incredible journey for all of us.
Yes.
So we'll see you next time here on Post Cut, where we will be reviewing the film Next Gen. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. We are Post Cut Podcast.